Norbert was his son's personal football, tennis and skiing teacher, and he taught by subjecting him to an ultra-competitive regimen. Early in the morning, come rain or shine, he would put me on the touchline on the pitch, let me start running for a bit, and then ran himself, overtaking me. Jürgen Klopp told Abendblatt in 2009 it was a far cry from being fun. The exercise was repeated week after week, until Klopp was faster than his dad. Norbert also registered him with the athletics club to improve his pace. In addition, Jürgen would have to spend hours practicing headers, just like his old had done before him. Age six, he joined the E youth team, under 11s, of SV Glatten, newly formed by coach Ulrich Ruth in 1973. In his first game, Jürgen was tackled and did an involuntary somersault, breaking his collarbone on impact. The very next week, he was back, his arm in a sling, staring longingly at his teammates from the sidelines and running to catch wayward balls, just to be involved somehow, Ruth says. That showed you what he was all about. He takes his visitor down a few steps, deeper into local history. Ruth's basement is a shrine to all things SV Glatten. Naturally, it's the team of youngsters, including his two sons and Jürgen Klopp, his third one, the son of all Glatten, that takes pride of place. Ruth still gets upset when the media refers to Klopp as a Stuttgarter. "He was only there for 1 week, in the first few days after his birth." He shakes his head and takes out a photo. Here they all are as nine-year-olds celebrating a cup win in a regional tournament played on Pfingsten, Pentecost. Klopp, the team's striker, later self-mockingly joked that it was the only trophy he ever won as a footballer. Hundreds of hobby footballers have since won the Klopp trophy, but only a few of them know much about that fact. It had been Norbert Klopp's idea, Ruth recalls, to cobble together a prize for the winners of Glatten's inaugural Open tournament in 1977. He took one of his son's football boots, spray-painted it gold, and mounted it on a wooden box. That same year, Stuttgarter kickers under-11s came to Glatten for a friendly game. The boys from the capital of Baden-Württemberg arrived with tents and slept in the nearby woods, where pigs were roasted on an open fire. The occasion is fondly remembered for a rafting trip down the Gumpen, where the rivers Glatt and Lauter meet. Many of the kickers' lads fell into the water, among them an eventual European Cup winner, Robert Brosnicki. The future playmaker of Red Star Belgrade and Yugoslavia Croatia was playing for the Swabians at the time, but was ultimately deemed not good enough. He returned to Zagreb 2 years later, aged 10. Jürgen, like most boys from the region, supported Kickers' bigger, more successful rivals, VfB Stuttgart. A trial as a youngster was unsuccessful, but he did get a red tracksuit, which he proudly wore until Stephanie ruined it in an accident with a hot iron. Perhaps to make up for that tragic loss, his grandmother Anna famously knitted him a white jumper with a red hoop and a 4 on the back, the number of his favourite player, West Germany international, Karl-Heinz Forster. He wore it on trips to the Neckarstadion with friends and family. Klopp admired the hard-nosed centre-back's calmness under pressure and utter dedication. "We later found out that we had the same sporting idol," says Martin Kvast. Forster, a man with strategic vision, and Boris Becker, who lived off impulse and emotions. Klopper once told me that he would be standing on the terraces as an ultra if football hadn't worked out for him, and that he had the red hoop implanted in his chest. His love for VfB might have cooled a little in subsequent years. Ulrich Ruth is moved to tears, recalling the day when Klopp, as coach of Mainz 05, evaded officious stewards and jumped over an advertising hoarding in Stuttgart Stadium to seek out a delegation of his old friends from Glatten, who were sitting in the Untertürkheimer Curve section. I said to him, "Jürgen, I have a dilemma. Two hearts are beating in my chest, one for VfB and one for you." He said, "Ulrich, that can't be true. A man only has one heart, and yours is beating for me." We all laughed, but I think he was very serious. Norbert Klopp was one of those football dads who could barely contain his passion on the sidelines. Jürgen has his father's temperament and his mother's calmness, Isolde Reich says. He felt the force of his father's uncompromising, exacting standards most acutely when it came to individual sports. Matches between the two Klopps were painfully one-sided affairs, with Norbert unwilling to cede a single point. Jürgen was frustrated, angry even, getting played off the court by a father who was either unable or disinclined to offer any words of support. Neither party enjoyed these early sessions, but Klopp Sr. considered them a necessary part of Jürgen's sporting education. They later paired up as their doubles team for Glatten's tennis club. His father was so obsessed with winning that he once refused to leave the pitch even though he was suffering from a bad sunstroke and was beset by violent chills. Klopp Jr. stopped the match of his own volition and put his father to bed. On the piste, Norbert simply skied downhill, expecting the boy to catch up. Nix geschwatzt ich lob naug, to say nothing is praise enough, a Swabian proverb goes. Norbert Klopp was its living embodiment. It was his way of getting me to perform, Klopp said in an interview with Der Tagesspiegel. When I ran and did skips, he say it wasn't high enough, that there was still space for a whole sheet of paper. He didn't have the right text available. His tactic was quite obvious. I sussed it out early. Klopp had to learn to read between the lines. To discover traces of his father's contentment, he added, seamless criticism smothered affirmation. When I scored 4 goals, he would say that I missed 7 other chances, or talk about how well one of my teammates had done. Nevertheless, I knew that he was secretly very proud of me. Left to his own devices after school, Klopp would play more football with Rath's sons, Hartmut and Ingo. Every patch of grass was transformed into a pitch, and after sunset, Klopp would continue to play in the living room, throwing himself on a couch to save shots or shooting at a small goal that Norbert had put up for him. The house was always full of kids. Jürgen was spoilt by our mum. Anything to make him happy, says Sister Isolde. A couple of glass panels of the cabinet had to break before the leather ball was replaced by one made from foam. He played and played until he fell asleep exhausted under the dining table. Ulrich Rath laughs. In the town's sports hall, blue mats had to serve as goals in lieu of the real thing. Rath had introduced a weekly sports hour for boys in the 70s. We were doing gymnastics, but the boys always wanted to play football, he says. Jürgen Klopp, nicknamed Kloppel, Little Klopp, was often sent forward to ask Herr Rath on behalf of his friends. Jürgen was a decent tennis player, but in his head he was always a footballer. He was quick, dynamic, and explosive. He had to kick every ball, even if one or two flew wide and high over the goal. Heading was his speciality. For a few games I played him as a sweeper, but that wasn't his position. Attack was his calling. It was totally idyllic, Klopp told SWR in 2005. There were only 5 or 6 boys of our age in that little village, and we were the football team, the tennis team, and the ski team. It was wonderful. I had a great childhood. Jürgen found going to school easy, at least in the literal sense. He only had to cross the street from his family home to get to Glatten's primary school. For 3rd and 4th grade, the Rath brothers and him took a bus south to the village of Nuneck. Local legend had it that there was an illegal brothel there at the time, run privately in the back room of a pub. All attempts by the curious schoolboys to find that secretive place of rural sin proved futile, however. Jürgen was not a guy to be 100% punctual, but you could rely on him 1,000% as a mate, says Hartmut Rath, the godfather of Klopp's son Mark, born in 1988. When the boys weren't kicking a ball around, they built models and solved puzzles. Klopp had an arty streak, he adds. He had a huge interest in culture and listened to many records and tapes of cabaret artists. His favourite was Phipps Asmussen, a 100-jokes-a-minute comedian whose early work was more political and satirical and no doubt funnier too. Jürgen was a genius in telling jokes. He made everyone in class laugh. He was extremely popular, the life and soul of the classroom, Hartmut Rath says. Jürgen Klopp has credited Hardy for helping him pass his Abitur, A-levels. That might be pushing the truth a little bit, but Hartmut admits that his friend, who excelled in languages and sports but was rather less proficient in sciences, did benefit from sitting next to him in class during exams. Copying was easier in those days. The younger of the Rath brothers laughs. They both went to the pro gymnasium, grammar school, in Dorfstetten, and shared a classroom from 8th grade onwards. Klopp had been in a class with Ingo Rath the first 2 years, but went on a lap of honour, repeating a year, in German school kid parlance, on the advice of his teachers. School wasn't the most important thing to him, Hartmut Ruth smiles. He was more into football and girls. But he was a good kid, somebody who respected his teachers and rarely got into trouble. Hardy estimates that the two of them were only given detention a couple of times per year. Other transgressions came with their own swift punishment. Aged 14, Klopp and his friends took part in an open football tournament. Entrants were supposed to be at least 16, but as one of the organisers, Norbert Klopp, looked the other way. The boys played badly, but still took home the first prize, a bottle of whiskey, when the victorious side didn't show at the winner's ceremony. Jürgen and the Raths imbibed their ill-gotten spoils outside the marquee and came home feeling much the worse for wear. The Kloppel moniker was soon ditched for Der Lange, the long one, as he started towering over class and teammates. After 10th grade, Hardy and Klopp went to the Eduard Spranger Wirtschaftsgymnasium in Freudenstadt to prepare for their Arbiter. Jürgen had a scooter from the age of 15, then drove a couple of 2CVs. Ente, duck, Germans called it, one of which was the colour of Bordeaux red. Robert Mongiati, one of Norbert Klopp's best friends, serviced the car outside the family residence. Jürgen later inherited a bright yellow VW Golf from sister Stephanie. A school friend often invited class members to study in a secluded garden shed. The curriculum wasn't always strictly adhered to by any means. In Ruth's basement and Norbert Klopp's garage, the teenagers threw parties playing spin the bottle. If somebody's parents were away, bedrooms were made available to couples. Although details are sketchy, French kissing was very probably on the syllabus. Klopp's class went to the city of Port-sur-Saône on a school exchange, speaking exclusively French for 2 weeks. The boys enjoyed their time in Burgundy so much, they returned for a camping holiday the following summer. Jürgen was the leader as far as social activities were concerned, Hartmut Ruth says. He was outgoing, he was part of the school's theatre group. He was interested in loads of different things. People used to say he had an eye for the bigger picture. There were often heated political discussions between Jürgen and his more conservatively minded father. In 1998, 3 weeks before his planned retirement, Norbert Klopp fell ill. Cancer of the liver. Doctors gave him 3 weeks to 3 months to live. The diagnosis came as a total shock to the family. Norbert had led a healthy, sporty life. He didn't smoke. "The cancer won't get me," he vowed. He resolved to stay upbeat and found encouragement in Lance Armstrong's book on beating testicular cancer. The children took him to many different clinics. His liver was surgically removed, frozen, and re-implanted. He lived for over 2 more years, determined to enjoy every single day. His traditional view of men and women changed. "He was more understanding of my rebellious streak and my quest for freedom," Isolde Reich says. Shortly before his death in 2000, a weak Norbert pushed himself to the limit and beyond to once more play a tennis match with the club. His testimonial. His victory. The Klopps found solace in Norbert fulfilling his very last wish. For the last 2 weeks of his life, the family took him home to Glatten. The two sisters were by his side, taking turns to hold his hand day and night. "Jürgen suffered a lot," Isolde says, "being unable to be with his father as much as he wanted due to his playing commitments with Mainz. He came home one night after a game and spent the night in Norbert's room, then drove off to train with 05, having slept very little. It was the first great fortune of my life to do exactly what my father had wanted to do," Jürgen Klopp said later. "I lived the life he had dreamt about. Any other job for me would have caused friction, I think. My father wouldn't have understood if I wanted to become, let's say, a florist. He wouldn't have said, 'No problem, I'll buy the first bouquet.' No. He would have thought I was crazy." After Norbert's death, Jürgen wanted answers, but eventually determined that somebody up there surely had a plan. The sadness Klopp feels about his father not having lived long enough to witness his success as a coach is tempered by his religious outlook. "I'm pretty certain, or at least believe very strongly, that he can see me, looking down in a relaxed manner," he said. Being constantly told to do better on the pitch, on the court, on the piste, was perhaps not a young boy's idea of paternal devotion. 40 years later, however, Jürgen Klopp has certainly come to realise that spending all those weekends pushing his son further along an infinitely demanding scale was Norbert's way of being affectionate. for a father's love is not measured in words, nor kisses, but in time. Chapter 6. Wolfgang Frank, the Master. Our father was brutally self-disciplined. Some might say he was a little obsessed, says Benjamin Frank, 36, sitting alongside his older brother Sebastian, 39, over a lunch of pasta and bittersweet memories in a Mainz hotel. The Franks work as agents and scouts for Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool FC. Before that, they were consulting for Leicester City, the surprise Premier League champions of 2015-16. They grew up in Glarus, a slow-paced Swiss valley town of 12,000 people who revered their father Wolfgang as a hero. The former Bundesliga striker, 215 games, 89 goals for VfB Stuttgart, Eintracht Braunschweig, Borussia Dortmund and one FC Nürnberg, had taken local Minnows FC Glarus to Nationalliga B, the Swiss second division, for the first time in their history as player-manager in 1988. Frank Sr., the brothers recall, saw no difference between being a coach and being a father. Both roles came down to the same thing, a duty to educate. He was a freak in a positive sense, says Sebastian, an immensely ambitious man for whom football wasn't just games and tactics, but everything, a school of life. During his last season as a pro, Wolfgang Frank had qualified as a teacher, specialising in sport and religion. Both subjects instilled in him the belief that there was no such thing as coincidence, that everything, injuries, defeats, happened for a reason, Benjamin Frank says. He was consumed with passing on that one central article of faith to anyone who would listen. The young boys had to go on regular endurance runs through ice and snow around the town. A few years later in Greece, on one of the very few family holidays Wolfgang's busy schedule allowed, the teenage brothers woke up at 5 a.m. every day for a run along the beach, followed by breakfast with vitamin pills, then a second session with weights before lunch. Late at night or early in the morning, the fax machine in their home in Glarus would start bleeping. Frank was sending through pages with motivational phrases and advice or intricate training schedules paired with best wishes and greetings from hundreds of kilometres away at one of the 15 clubs he coached during his career. Every time we had a problem in school or in sport, a long fax would arrive, cheering us up and showing us that he had thought long and hard about the problem from a distance, in his own way, says Benjamin. As a player, Wolfgang had been fascinated by the playing style of Arrigo Sacchi's AC Milan, a team that dominated European football in the late 1980s and early 90s thanks to their revolutionary collective tactics, a synchronicity of movement that suffocated opponents by depriving them of space and time. He would study the players' unified manoeuvres on videos late into the night and also mull over the importance of regeneration, nutrition and mental training at a time when such topics were considered esoteric in Germany. In Switzerland, by contrast, the lack of funds and the much smaller player pool has facilitated a more open-minded approach. Zonal marking, a system that replaced the defending team's focus on the opposition forwards with a primary concern to defend the space in front of a goal and attack the ball, had been adopted as early as 1986 under the auspices of Swiss national coach Daniel Jean Dupuy. Internationals brought knowledge of the system back to their clubs, where some continue to work on it of their own volition, as former defender Andy Egli recalled. Jean Dupuy, Egli believed, had first encountered the playing style as a pro and coach in France. Frank understood that tactical innovation could be a small club's weapon in their battle with bigger and better sides, that the right ideas could markedly increase the quality of your own performance. His miraculous success with FC Glarus saw him appointed at FC Aarau, a provincial first division side that had experienced unexpected triumphs themselves under the guidance of German coach Ottmar Hitzfeld. Hitzfeld, who had gone to win the Champions League with Borussia Dortmund and Bayern Munich, had done so well at the unfashionable club that his side had become known as the FC Wunder in the media in 1985. They were runners-up in the league and won the Swiss Cup. Frank, too, took Aarau all the way to the Swiss Cup final, in the first half-season in charge, 1989-1990. But the miracle ran short. The Argovians were beaten 2-1 by Hitzfeld's Grasshoppers Zurich in Bern. Frank departed a year later. He subsequently failed to make a mark in positions at relegation battlers FC Wettingen in 1991 to 1992 and second division FC Winterthur 1992 to 93. The key player and captain at Winterthur, incidentally, was a veteran German striker called Joachim Lau. The Germany manager, then in his early 30s, once stood up in the dressing room to defend the team against Frank's criticism. Lau also tried his hand at fashion. He sold novelty ties out of his car boot to Winterthur teammates. At last, Frank got a chance, of sorts, to prove himself back in his home country in January 1994. Rot-Weiss Essen, a well-supported second division side from Germany's industrial and football heartland, the Ruhr, needed a new manager after Jürgen Rober had been poached by VfB Stuttgart during the winter break. However, before he'd even taken charge at the Jörg Melcher Stadion, Frank and his team had been doomed to relegation. The German FA had withdrawn the club's professional license in the wake of financial irregularities. On top of that, Frank had a dressing room revolt on his hands on his first day in the job. Captain Ingo Pickenacker and his deputy Frank Kurth had resigned in protest, as they had not been consulted about Röber's successor, despite a promise from the board. RWE were hopeful the German FA might show some leniency on appeal. The club's astute lawyer, Reinhard Raubal, now president of Borussia Dortmund, unearthed many procedural mistakes on the behalf of the football authority. Sensationally, Frank's men won the DFB Pokal semi-final against Tennis Borussia 2-0 in March to reach the cup final in Berlin. But the enforced drop to Division 3 was confirmed by an arbitration panel a few days later. All of their goals and points were chalked off. In May, 35,000 Essen supporters travelled to the German capital in a mood of defiance. There were many banners decrying the unfairness of the German FA's decision. "If there's justice in the heavens, we will win," said Frank. Down on the Olympic Stadium pitch, however, odds-on favourites Werder Bremen, coached by Otto Rehhagel, were indifferent to the prospect of divine retribution. The Northerners, who had lifted the Cup Winners' Cup courtesy of a 2-0 defeat of Arsene Wenger's AS Monaco 2 years earlier, ran out easy winners in Berlin. Final score, 3-1. Decades later, it emerged that an ugly political intrigue had played its part in the defeat. RWE's Frank Cotney still hesitates to reveal a story he calls the darkest moment of my playing career. The 52-year-old was captain at the time and destined to start the final in defence. But on the morning of the game, Frank told me that I was out of the squad and that I had to find a new employer if I wanted to play again, he says. My world came crashing down that day. The greatest ever game was taken away from me. Like most RWE players, Cotney was working part-time away from football to support his family during the club's insolvency. Board member Wolfgang Thulius had arranged a job for him as a property agent. After the club had reached the DFB Pokal final in March, new people had come in and won control of the board. They seemed to put pressure on Frank to cut all ties with the old regime. Cotney: I was on the wrong side of the divide, and unfortunately, Frank took a decision that had no basis in football. In Cotney's place, the manager started Pickenacker, who had suffered a serious groin injury just a few weeks before and wasn't quite ready. Pickenacker was at fault for Werder's first two goals and was subbed off 7 minutes before half-time. Essen rallied after the break, pulled one back through Daoud Bangura, but Wynton Rufer secured Werder's 3-1 win in a late penalty. I'm convinced it would have been a different game with me on the pitch, says Cotney, with a heavy heart. I was very disappointed in Frank. I cursed him. He was a good coach. He always said we had to keep learning and expand our horizons. Training sessions lasted 2 hours. But I think today he would recognise that he'd made a big mistake. 3 weeks after the final, Rot-Weiss travelled to Mainz for the penultimate game of the season, a tumultuous match at the Brückfeldstadion, attendance 3,000, with three red cards, two for the away team, ended with a 90th-minute equaliser by 05 midfielder Zlatko Buvac that made it 1-1 and mathematically confirmed the home side's safety from relegation. In September 1995, perennial strugglers Mainz were once again bottom of the table in Bundesliga 2 and on the lookout for a new man on the bench. General manager Christian Heidel contacted Frank. The last straw man, Rhein Zeitung, called him. He came over and said a lot of things that sounded very nice and lovely, Heidel says, with playful irony. He had the demeanour of a teacher. I'm always careful with teacher types. They're sometimes not easy to deal with. But after a while I said, okay, why don't you do it? In hindsight, that was a momentous day for Mainz 05. I'd like to tell you that I knew straight away that he was a good coach. But the truth is, nobody else wanted to coach us. The team were impressed by training methods they perceived as quite sophisticated, Heidel. But they kept losing their games regardless. Mainz went into the winter break as the worst team in the division, with 12 points on the board, 5 adrift of safety. Heidel. Kicker magazine wrote, Mainz's chance of relegation, 100%. Not 99%, 100%. I'll never forget that. Frank knocked on Heidel's door. He said, we have to make a change. I thought, yes, you can say that again. He told me he'd thought things through and decided that we would go into the winter training camp and play without a sweeper in future. I said to myself, what? Can he be serious? A professional football team without a libero or sweeper, a last man behind the defence, was largely inconceivable in mid-90s Germany. The clubs and the national team had won all their big trophies with a libero since Franz Beckenbauer's heyday in the 1970s. We all believe that you needed somebody as a safeguard in case the opposition got behind your line, says Heidel. How could you get rid of the sweeper? Impossible. I'd played as a sweeper myself, so it felt to me as if he was attempting to get rid of me as well, in a way. Former Germany international Hans Bongartz had employed a version of a sweeperless flat back four as early as 1986 at one FC Kaiserslautern. He had been inspired by a defeat at the hands of Sven-Goran Eriksson's tactically ahead of the curve team IFK Göteborg in the 1982 UEFA Cup semi-final, but hadn't made a lasting impression in the German top flight with his innovation. As president at FC Bayern, Beckenbauer expressly forbade Eric Ribbick from continuing his admittedly rather amateurish experiments with four at the back in 1993-94. A few weeks after Frank's appointment at Mainz, national team manager Bertie Vogts told Swiss tabloid Blick that a system without a sweeper was fundamentally destructive and thus not destined to find acceptance in the Bundesliga. Heidel. I thought we'd be a laughingstock. I was very fatalistic. During the training camp, I vowed that I would take a closer look. There were all these poles on the pitch, and the players thought, this guy's lost his mind. For hours, they ran around without the ball. They practiced moving from side to side in formation. Today, it's obvious that one flank is left open as the back four move towards the side of the pitch where the ball is. But when we played the first game at home that way, the whole stadium was shouting at us. An opposition striker was by himself all the way to the left, but the whole of our team was on the right. Nobody realised then that the ball couldn't get to the left that quickly, that the defence had enough time to shift back over. Ball-orientated zonal marking, that was called. And it was a completely new thing in Germany. Witchcraft, basically. So we trained and trained and trained. And I was certain we'd get relegated. In the mid-90s, practice sessions essentially came in two flavours. There was work, lots of running, and there was fun, playing. Exercises in collective movement or theoretical study were unheard of. Frank, by contrast, was possessed by tactics. Heidel says, I'd never seen anything like that before. The coach spent hours watching football, especially Italian football, and Sacchi was still his idol. He showed us all of his matches on videotapes. I was always there. A general manager has to be there, Frank said. So I had to watch all that crap too. There was no editing then. He would pause the picture, rewind, play, and rewind again for hours on end. He was crazy for Sacchi's tactics. Frank also travelled to Italy to see the master's training in person. Sacchi didn't take him seriously, but he was allowed to watch from the sidelines, says Heidel. That's where he got his ideas from. We weren't nearly as advanced in Germany. In sports science, Professor Dr. Dieter Augustin from Mainz University, located a short walk from the stadium, Frank had met a fellow football theorist. Augustin preferred acutely structured positional play to FSV's verticality, but differences in taste notwithstanding, they both agreed that players needed visual aids to further their footballing education. Students from Augustine's course were asked to put together short video clips of Mainz and their opponents to help their match preparation. A simple but original idea. German teams had neither the staff nor the know-how to work with video analysts then. One of the young sports scientists who volunteered for the experiment was Peter Kravets. He would later become Mainz's chief scout and Klopp's trusted assistant. Frank's video sessions at 7:30 in the morning were much feared. Former 05 player Torsten Liebenecht said, "We sat on these garden chairs made from steel in a tiny room and had breakfast, while Wolfgang Frank was pushing buttons on the video player. It took forever." Frank also found inspiration from his playing days. A year at AZ of Alkmaar in the Dutch Eredivisie in 1973 and 1974 had seen him marvel at Ajax's total football. Upon his return to Germany, the slender forward nicknamed Flo, or Flea, had reunited with his former Stuttgart coach, Branko Zebek, at newly promoted Eintracht Braunschweig. Zebek, a Yugoslavian who had led Bayern Munich to the first ever Bundesliga title in 1969, with a punishing fitness regime and strong tactical discipline, was the first manager to experiment with zonal marking in the German top flight in the mid-70s. Everybody was still strictly man-marking then. We no longer stupidly ran after our individual opponents under Zebek. He was ahead of his time, Frank later recalled. 21 years later, Mainz were craving similarly futuristic impulses. "We were practically dead as a team during the winter break," Mainz defender Klopp told Süddeutsche Zeitung in 1999. "We were open for new ideas. We would even climbed up a tree 15 times for the promise of some points in return." Frank estimated that it took 150 hours of theoretical training before the new system was internalized. Instead of the usual fun-packed training German pros were accustomed to, they spent entire days without the ball. But we thought, if Hullet and Van Basten had to learn that at Milan, we could put up with it as well. Klopp later said in an interview alongside his mentor with Frankfurter Rundschau in 2007, "You have to realize how courageous that was. In football, it takes a long time to put new things into place. Wolfgang introduced four at the back in the middle of a raging relegation battle. We had basically been in the jungle before he came. We had chased after everyone in an opposition shirt." Frank, he remembered thinking, might as well have told the team to take an exam in quantum physics for all we knew about four at the back. The football at Mainz had been quite conservative, but something had to happen. The time was ripe for it, Frank explained. "The team," Heidel says, "were not entirely convinced from the start. They didn't know what was happening to them. All this running around without the ball, to the left, to the right. Frank explained to me over many hours in an Italian restaurant that one fewer guy at the back would mean that we had an extra guy in midfield. And I would say, yes, but what if one guy just runs straight through on goal? Then he said, there won't be anyone running through. There mustn't be. Up front, we were pressing to force the opposition into playing long balls. At the back, we had giants like Klopp, 1.93 metres, who won all the headers. That was our new game. That's how we left the training camp." A first friendly with the new setup pitted them against 3rd Division 1 FC Saarbrücken, a money team, who led their league by miles and were certain to go up, Heidel remembers. "It was in Frauenlauten, near the French border, and I was pretty sure we'd concede 5 goals. But at half-time, we were 6-0 up. I thought I was dreaming. They had their best 11 out, but no idea how to play against us. They were completely overwhelmed. That was the birth, the rebirth, of Mainz 05 and the birth of the back four in the second division. We were the first to play it this way, in conjunction with ball-orientated zonal marking." Ralf Rangnick at Ulm and Uwe Rappholder at Waldhof Mannheim came afterwards. Former Mainz defender Jürgen Cramny played for Saarbrücken in that game. "I was there when Mainz's four at the back came into life," he says. "We were a pretty decent side in the third division, and Mainz were up against relegation in Bundesliga 2. But we had no chance. They killed us. They played us off the park." Jürgen Klopp, Peter Neustadter, Michael Müller and Uwe Stöver were the four defenders that day. "It worked so well that we didn't change at all for the next 18 months," Klopp said. Frank described his tactics as a sophisticated version of children's football. Everybody had to go where the ball was. The aim was to create numerical superiority to win the ball, then to sprawl out like a fist that opens. These novel methods turned Mainz into the best team of the Bundesliga 2 or Rückrunde, second half of the season. They won 32 points, more than any other team in the top two divisions. It was nuts, unheard of in German professional football, Heidel smiles. For Klopp, it was an epiphany. I realised that our system made us beat teams that had better players. He made our results independent of our talent to an extent. Up until then, we thought that as the worst team, we would lose. Frank's great strength was to have a concise match plan. It was widely accepted that hard work or wanting it more than your opponent could make up a little for inferior quality. But a collective concept based on the utilization of space? Nobody in Germany had thought it possible that it could make such a difference. I fell in love with tactics for the first time, Heidel says. Suddenly we could beat teams that were individually better than us simply because we had an idea that worked. The team practiced until they passed out, he adds. Eventually, everybody got it. Today, it's commonplace to have smart, adaptable players, but back then, you needed a few heads who could lead the others. Kloppo, of course, was the tactical head of the team. Even if his game didn't look like that, he relied on his power, on his emotions, on his physicality as a player. He wasn't one for playing nice stuff, but he was the team's brain. At Mainz, I came into contact with tactics for the first time, said former FSV midfielder Christian Hock, who had played at Eintracht Frankfurt in his youth and for Borussia Mönchengladbach's first team. Tactics were never coached at Borussia. It took a long time to learn the system. It was very unfamiliar. You had to watch the ball and the men at the same time constantly. Years later, when I was doing my coaching badges, many former players had real problems understanding the back four theoretically. Thanks to Wolfgang Frank, I was already very used to it. Wolfgang's aim was always for us players to learn new things, Klopp said. We were not just supposed to meet up to play a bit of football at the weekend. Of course, we sometimes complained when we spent 4 hours on shape work on the pitch, but we always understood why we were doing that. Klopp remembered Frank telling local journalists not to write too much about the back four because he knew he'd have a lot of explaining to do in the case of defeats. The break with tradition was viewed with plenty of suspicion. Despite the marked upswing in results, the disastrous opening half of the 1995-96 campaign had left survival still in grave doubt ahead of the last game of the season, at home to VfL Bochum. Mainz had to win. TV reporter Martin Kvast remembers covering the game. There were 12,000 people at the Bruchweg, nearly sold out at the time. Marco Weishaupt scored early on. 83 incredibly tense minutes later, Mainz was safe. Everyone went wild celebrating with their hands in the air, but Wolfgang Frank had a serious face on and walked up and down like a caged tiger. He didn't know what to do. The situation was totally alien to him. Thousands were parting like there's no tomorrow, and Wolfgang Frank staggered around the pitch, totally withdrawn, as if somebody was controlling him remotely. Everyone celebrated, but my father was totally exhausted, unable to say a single word and suffering from a terrible headache, Sebastian Frank says. He had left it all out there. Wolfgang Frank was one of those coaches who'd do 100 miles an hour stuck in neutral gear on the sideline, ablaze on the inside but unable to find an outlet for all that energy. He didn't want to be the centre of attention, Sebastian says. Bathing in adulation was not his thing. The next season we all stayed together and no one knew how to handle us, Heidel reminisces. For the first time in Mainz's history, we were all of a sudden challenging for promotion to the Bundesliga. No one's ever taken this club seriously. They've been marooned in no man's land for years, Süddeutsche Zeitung wrote in October 1996. But now, they are the only team in the second division who play and understand four at the back. The self-styled carnival club suddenly commanded respect and admiration for its radical ways. We've suddenly been gripped by euphoria, 05 president Harald Strutz was quoted as saying. The whole city stirred with excitement as never before. And 05 kept on winning. Frank's team went into the 1996-97 winter break second in the table, only behind Otto Rehagel's number one FC Kaiserslautern, who would claim the Meisterschaft a year later. Yet for Frank, progress couldn't come quickly enough. At the same time as he'd introduced the fundamental changes to the team's tactics, in January 1996, he'd surprised the board with demands for a bigger, modernized stadium and better training facilities. The Bruchweg Stadion had only just had floodlights and an electronic scoreboard installed a few months earlier. He taught us that we needed to have a vision if we wanted to achieve things that was decisive, says Strutz. He asked us straight up, "Do you want to play in the Bundesliga one day?" I'm not sure anyone had really thought about that here before. We were still bottom of Bundesliga 2 then. Frank's vision was to renovate the Bruchweg. The name, literal translation, broken path, was very fitting then. Strutz concedes, and he demanded the installation of a plunge bath and a sauna, as well as better pitches. Wolfgang Frank was a unique person, very distinctive, a wonderful man, but overly intellectual, spiritualized. He drove the Mainz board nuts with his demands to make success sustainable. I remember he insisted on the plunge bath. All Mainz had at the time was a grubby bathtub where the kit man washed the boots sometimes. After a game, the team captain would be in there, so nobody else could cool down. Frank was adamant. New pitches, new changing rooms. The press room can't be here, in the centre of the building where the players are, he said. Slow progress was regression to him. Everything had to change at turbo pace. The tiny VIP area in one of the containers that also housed administration was converted into a chill-out room, replete with lounges for the players to use during the week. There was talk of hiring a nutritionist. He wanted to show prospective players that we had the facilities to train them well. That was very important to him, Strutz says. And he was always surprised that the bulldozers didn't turn up the very next day to start the renovations. The board must have thought I was bananas, Frank admitted years later. In the club anthology Karneval am Bruchweg, local football reporters Reinhard Rehberg and Christian Kahn write that negotiations with the stadium's owners, the Mainz City Council, were fraught. The politicians didn't see the justification for spending serious money on a club that only got 3,000 to 5,000 regulars through the turnstiles. Undeterred by such niceties, Frank kept pushing internally until Mainz had funding in place for a modest stadium extension. He was not an easy coach nor an easy person, says Strutz. He was a complicated personality to deal with, for me as president of the club. He had so much drive. He wanted the club to develop rapidly. In January 1997, the unlikely promotion contenders went to Cyprus to prepare for the second half of the season. The Frank brothers were there as well, as youth players. Some of the pros were in tears laughing at us because we had to join in with the team's core stability exercises on the adjoining pitch, Benjamin recalls. Our father said, "Don't worry what the others think, just do your thing." 7 years later, German tabloids and battle-hardened pundits laughed too when Jürgen Klinsmann had the national team practicing similar drills under the auspices of American fitness coaches. Those exercises became standard practice at club level after the 2006 World Cup. When reports of fresh snowfall in Mainz reached Cyprus at the end of a 10-day training camp, Frank decreed that he and the team should stay for another fortnight to take advantage of the perfect training conditions on the island. The players were less than pleased. They wanted to go home to their families. But the club was so enthralled to the first coach that had ever brought them a semblance of success that they bowed to his every wish. We were second in the table. Mainz 05, second in the table, Heidel exclaims for effect. If Frank had said, "Tomorrow, the church tower should be knocked down," then we would have gone up there and knocked the church tower down. We'd never been at the top before. Everything he said was immediately put into practice. After what must have been the longest training camp in the history of German professional football, Mainz came back and lost the first game at home to Hertha BSC, 1-0. They also lost the second game, 3-0 away, to VfB Leipzig, and then they lost their coach, Heidel. I stayed behind in Leipzig because of an event. The next day, I'm sitting in a taxi and Frank calls me. "Christian," he says, "I just wanted to tell you that you'll have to find a new coach." So I'm thinking, for the summer? Because his contract was up after the season. But then it dawned on me that he meant now, straight away. I flew back to Mainz and four journalists were waiting at the stadium. That was a lot by our standards. He had already told all of them that he was leaving, just like that. Frank had spent the entire journey back from Leipzig brooding over the reasons for the two defeats. Somehow he had concluded that he himself was the reason. Heidel describes Frank resigning as a Kurzschlussreaktion, a short-circuiting. Not even Jürgen Klopp, the coach's confidant in the dressing room, was able to change his mind. Frank's successor was a man called Reinhard Saftig, a seasoned, mustachioed operator with experience in the Bundesliga, Dortmund, Leverkusen, and Turkey, Kocaelispor and Galatasaray, a safe pair of hands, or so Heidel thought. Signing him was truly one of my finest hours, he winces. Saftig didn't have the faintest idea, I have to be honest. He didn't have a clue about the game. Of course, we didn't get promoted. We messed up on the last day of the season in Wolfsburg. We lost 4-5 there, so Wolfsburg went up in our place. A legendary game with a grandiose Jurgen Klopp. Playing as a right-back, Klopp scored a goal as the away team battled back from being 3-1 and one man down to equalise, but also made a calamitous mistake to seal Mainz's defeat. The game had effectively been a promotion playoff. Frank, in the meantime, had moved on to coach FK Austria Wien. Benjamin remembers being in the car with his father on the way to the airport. He hardly said anything. All he did was memorise the names of the Austria players by heart. He wanted to know them all ahead of the first training session. The Viennese side, a modest collection of journeymen that included the impossibly hirsute Bulgarian international, Trifon Ivanov, was bewildered by Frank's system, as Saftig was at Mainz, where the team still believed in his predecessor's system. Attempts to switch back to a three-man defence, with the newly signed Cramley as a sweeper, proved disastrous. Saftig apparently liked taking nightcaps with the players before games. Key figures such as Jurgen Klopp feared these invitations. Saftig was thirsty and had stamina. After 5 months at the Bruchweg, Saftig was replaced by the Austrian Dietmar Constantini. He had worked as an assistant to the legendary Ernst Happel and explained to bemused journalists that Mainz's pressing game followed the shape of a bagpipe. In practice, that meant the introduction of Frank's back four with an important difference. There was a sweeper behind them too, in Cramley. Heidel. So we had four in a line in defence, plus a sweeper behind them. Kloppo was driven to distraction by that. We always had a relationship built on trust. He would come into my office and say, "The coach hasn't got any idea of tactics. We can't play like that. A back four with a sweeper?" That's when I sensed he might become a coach himself one day. Constantini didn't lose many games, but he didn't win many either. Only 4 out of 18. The King of Draws, Allgemeine Zeitung proclaimed him. Constantini's last game, a 3-1 home defeat to SG Wattenscheid 09, Suleiman Sané, the father of German international Leroy Sané, in attack, in early April 1998, saw Mainz slip into the relegation zone again. "The guys that came after Frank didn't trust in the back four," says Cramley. "They said the players were too slow to play that system and instead came up with all sorts of crazy schemes. But the team didn't buy into them. They fundamentally still believed in Frank's formation. That's why none of the other tactics worked for us." Constantini admitted to Heidel that he couldn't connect with the dressing room. The Mainz general manager swallowed his pride and called on the only coach he could think of who might be able to return the team to winning ways, Frank. His engagement at Vienna had run its course. Both sides had already agreed to part ways at the end of the season. After getting a call from Heidel, who sweet-talked him until 3 a.m, Frank left his post immediately to turn back the clock and save Mainz from the drop a second time. He won his first game 2-1 away to Stuttgarter Kickers, thanks to a quick injection of hope. "This guy burns so brightly with excitement," Klopp told the cameras after the final whistle. "If anyone can ring in the changes after only 3 days, it's him." Mainz finished in 10th position. The team were happily playing the system they were most comfortable with again. Having restored them to a flat back four and zonal marking, Frank shifted his focus to the conquest of an altogether different space, the one between the players' ears. He made it his mission to work on the team's mental strength, Strutt says. He went very far in that, with the introduction of psychological and autogenic training, a type of relaxation technique. He also employed an autogenic coach who, as we later found out, was a former train driver. He had changed jobs. Strutz, a former triple jumper and silver medalist in the German championships in 1969 and 1970, feels he's partly to blame for Frank's journey down the rabbit hole of the inner mind. "I gave him a book as a gift. De Macht der Motivation, The Power of Motivation, by Nicholas B. Enkelman, that I had myself been given as a Christmas present because I thought he might like it. But he adopted that psychological approach to the extent that it changed his life altogether. It went as far as breathing exercises and the repetition of mantras. It got very esoteric." Frank's home was filled with Enkelman's books and videos, his sons say. Each morning he'd wake up and conduct elocution lessons. Little notes with auto-suggestive phrases were stuck to the bathroom mirror. I will get stronger and stronger every day and such like. Those who didn't know him well thought it was sometimes a little odd or cranky, Benjamin concedes. In the winter training camp of 1998, again held in Cyprus, Mainz's players were instructed in speech therapy, training their vocal cords by repeatedly shouting out vowel sounds, much to the amusement of the Greuther Fürth team, who happened to be at the same hotel, and heard them scream out "ah" and "ooh" from the dining hall. Austrian goalkeeper Herbert Ilsanker once noticed that Frank was conducting an interview in the team sauna. Strange place for it, he thought. But even stranger still, Frank sat in the sauna alone, interviewing himself, to practice the way he addressed the team. His tone of voice was never monotonous. When he spoke to you, you were alert, Ilsanker told Allmann Zeitung. And Frank spoke a lot. Team meetings lasted an hour on average, and they were scheduled every single day. Things got a little out of hand, some thought, Klopp said. Players who had left school relatively early were suddenly reading books on the bus with titles I didn't even comprehend. Strutz. Our priorities shifted a little bit. Frank wanted to improve the players by giving them that personality stability. He wanted to show them that there was more to it than tactics and running, that you could beat your opponent through the power of the mind. Later, at Kickers Offenbach, Frank would place a table tennis ball on a bottleneck and asked his players to concentrate on flicking it away in full flight. How can I maximize my mental potential? That will be one of the decisive questions, he told Frankfurter Rundschau. Few believed him then, but many top coaches are today convinced that cognitive training and work on the shortening of reaction times is vital if players' minds are to keep up with an increasingly rapid game. To get better translates into taking things in more quickly, analysing them more quickly, deciding more quickly, acting more quickly, Ralf Rannick says. He was a disciplinarian, but also a communicator, remembers Sebastian. Very different to the Martinet-type coaches dominating the sport at the time. The way he dealt with us as players made us go, ah, look here, there is a different way, Klopp told Frankfurter Rundschau in 2007. He would also put the human being centre circle. We really liked him. When we lost, we had two problems. Firstly, that we lost. Secondly, that we had disappointed Wolfgang. That was pretty important to us. It was remarkable how he got the whole team behind him. Klopp and Frank sometimes argued, but they only once fell out with each other. Klopp had confessed to the coach during another training camp that he felt as if the coach was chucking a bucket of water over a glass that was already full and overflowing, and that many players felt the same way. Frank was insulted, and Klopp worried about getting fired. I didn't sleep all night. But the next day, things carried on as normal. I talked to players the way I would have liked coaches to talk to me, Frank said about his management style. Perhaps he didn't always hit the right note. Frank was a man with a very special character, says Storitz. He could have been a fantastic coach if he'd been a bit more relaxed. Unlike Jurgen Klopp later, he was simply too serious. And he didn't really understand that young players sometimes want to have fun and drink the odd beer, that they don't want to be boxed in. His sons paint a more nuanced picture. At home, they say Frank could be very funny, very warm. But he didn't like the limelight. He wasn't the type of guy who climbs the fence in front of the home section. My father, Sebastian Frank says, lost himself in the life of being a football coach. I'm not sure he knew the price of a bread roll. He sometimes found it hard to deal with normal life. His working day started at 7 in the morning with breakfast at the club and finished after midnight. Dad pushed himself to the very limit. He wanted to demonstrate that level of commitment to his players. Frank collected anything he considered useful for his job. He cut out articles, archived his training regime and schedule in big files. He soaked up everything, says Benjamin Frank. Like many obsessives, he found it impossible to delegate. He wanted total control, or at least needed to know everything that went on down to the last detail. Often there'd be arguments at home because he had again given his winning bonus, which was meant to supplement his modest wages, to the groundsman or somebody else at the club, insisting that they were just as important as the strikers or defenders. Frank regarded a football club as one large organism, not a company made up of different departments that had little to do with each other. His emotions as a coach were directed inwards. Once he got so disappointed and angry that he moved all the furniture out of his office at the club. Mainz pretended to everybody that they were renovating and repainting the room. The reason for Frank's anger had nothing to do with an argument with club officials or the players. No, his team had lost a cup game. Away to Bayern Munich. That was him, Sebastian Frank nods. He was certain that little old Mainz could win in Munich if they'd played at their very limit, and perhaps caught Bayern on a bad day. Klopp, incidentally, had watched the 3-0 defeat at the Olympic Stadium in the stands, having been sent off in the previous round for scything down Hertha BSC's Iranian striker, Ali Day. After the defender's dismissal, another Mainz player, Marcio Rodriguez, was shown the red card for an excessive goal-scoring celebration. The Brazilian didn't notice that Klopp was in the toilets in the dressing room and accidentally locked his teammate in once the match was over. With Frank in charge, 05 once again overachieved in relation to their minuscule budget. They finished seventh in 1998-99, and ninth a year later. But the man who had woken Mainz from their deep slumber, as Sudetendeutsche Zeitung years later acknowledged, was again impatient. He wanted to coach in the Bundesliga, and believed that MSV Duisburg, the Zebras, offered a better chance to earn his stripes at the highest level. But the move to the traditional mid-sized club from the Ruhr area backfired. Frank was axed 4 months into the next Bundesliga 2 season, with the team hovering near the relegation zone. His methods were met with rejection by large parts of the team from the start, Rheinpost noted. He had, amongst other things, instructed his players to hug trees during an endurance run through the woods. His next stint at SPV GG Unterhaching was more successful. He led the former top flight side, based in a suburb of Munich, from the third division to Bundesliga 2, but was sacked a year later. A campaign with SSC Farul Constantia in Romania proved another dead end. The roll call of his subsequent employers reads like a who's who of low division basket cases and clubs that specialised in racking up thwarted dreams and false dawns in lieu of points. FC Sachsen Leipzig, now defunct. Kickers Offenbach. Wuppertaler SV. SV Wien Wiesbaden, FC Carl Zeiss Jena, KAS Eupen, Belgium. It didn't really work out for him at any of them. Frank later admitted that he had perhaps taken on too few many clubs in his career. It would have been much better for him to wait for the right offer, but to be out of a job, not be able to put everything he had into his work, scared him, Sebastian Frank says. There was also the fear of getting forgotten and overlooked if he were to stay off the radar for too long. Our father often thought about what could have happened, where the journey could have taken him. Once, Werder Bremen had contacted him, but Frank had been sure he would find happiness in Austria at the time. The same happened again with Hansa Rostock a couple of years later. Our father had a huge knowledge base and visionary ideas, Benjamin Frank says. He came across as confident, but also secretly doubted himself all the time, as far as his work and his effect on the team was concerned. As a coach, he remained unfulfilled. He never quite made it into the big time because he was a difficult character, Heidel says. I was the only one he got along with. We were quite close until we fell out very badly. After he left us for the second time for Duisburg. We didn't talk to each other for 2 years. He always thought he could find something better. But neither party did. At the turn of the millennium, Frank's groundbreaking system was still so advanced by the standards of German football that subsequent Mainz coaches had little idea how to make it work. Tactically, the side were better than their coaches, Klopp said. The national team and the vast majority of club sides were still firmly wedded to a sweeper system. Heidel. At Mainz, half the players knew how to play with four at the back, and the other half didn't. And the coaches had no clue. We put anyone on the bench who happened to have a tracksuit in his wardrobe. But no one was able to explain to the players what they had already been taught by Wolfgang. We were basically dead in the winter of 2001. Finished. I said to Kloppo, you're smart. You're eloquent, you understand the game. Do you want to see if you can make it work? Within 2 weeks, he had it sorted. Klopp and Frank had had long discussions about football and the art of coaching, Benjamin Frank says. Klopp always asked questions. He wanted to know the purpose of specific drills. Dad advised him to write everything down. Team talks, tactics, training sessions, playing ideas. He had a sense that Klopp would make good use of it one day. Our father was certainly the inspiration behind him turning into a manager. On the day of the lanky defender's promotion to player coach, Mainz became the first club of note in Germany to put the cart before the horse. Starting with Klopp, coaches would now be picked to fit the squad,